Hello, welcome to everyone watching, listening online, to everyone gathered here in this space. Last week, we noticed how in John's account of Jesus' resurrection, seeing is not always believing. The first witnesses to the resurrection required something more from Jesus. And today we're going to read a story in which Jesus pronounces a blessing on those who believe without seeing. In John 20, after Jesus appears to Mary Magdalene at the empty tomb early on the first day of the week, she runs back to the other disciples, remember, and delivers to them the good news. She says, "I have seen the Lord." And then later that evening, all the disciples are gathered together in a room behind closed doors, behind locked doors, and Jesus suddenly appears to them, seemingly out of nowhere, to confirm what Mary has told them. And now they too have seen the Lord, and they rejoice. And then Jesus commissions them to carry on his mission in the world. And to that end, he breathes on them, which is a rather strange story we'll talk about in a few weeks. He breathes on them the Holy Spirit so that they can carry out their mission. Now let's pick up the story in John chapter 20, verse 24. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my fingers where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again. Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands? Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." And Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." And then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." I so identify with Thomas. I also feel badly for him. He picked a terrible day to skip church. All the other disciples are there, but not Thomas. And who knows why he didn't show up on Sunday evening? Maybe he got caught up in the Wizard of Oz. That is a deep cut inside joke. And if you know, I see some heads nodding, you know. Or maybe he didn't read the email with all the details about the meeting. He received the email. The email was there in his inbox. He just never read it, and yet he still complained about not knowing about the meeting. Again, if you know, you know. And I suppose if there's one guilt-trippy preacher point to glean from this story, it's this. Every time you skip church, you run the risk of missing Jesus because you never know when he might show up. And for 7 days, I'm sure Thomas feels alone, isolated, miserable. All the other disciples are talking about seeing Jesus and what Jesus had to say and when it might happen again and what it all means. Even their unanswered questions are bathed in joy, and there are plenty of unanswered questions. And even though they still don't understand all the implications, they do know this: Jesus is alive. But not Thomas. He cannot join in the celebration because he was not in the room where it happened. And he doesn't believe the testimony of the other disciples. They keep telling him, and it's more than one doing it. They're all saying the same thing, and he doesn't believe it. He doesn't want to hear about the risen Jesus. He wants to see the risen Jesus. He's an empiricist. He needs proof. He refuses to believe in anything he can't see and touch and verify for himself. But that doesn't mean his faith is less than or weaker than the other disciples. All he's asking for is the same experience with the risen Jesus that they had. All he wants to do is see the risen Jesus just like they did. Can we really fault Thomas for wanting the same thing we would all want? The same thing we all want right now? Wouldn't you prefer to see and touch and have a face-to-face conversation with the risen Jesus rather than just hearing someone talk about him? So for 7 long days, Thomas voices the struggle of those of us who hear the good news about Jesus' resurrection, but have never seen the risen Lord with our eyes. He's the spokesperson for all of us who would love to believe, but would also love to see some irrefutable proof before we go all in. And then the next week, Sunday night, the disciples are together again behind locked doors, and Thomas is right there with them. No more skipping church for him. In fact, I bet he didn't let the other disciples out of his sight for 7 days. I'm going wherever you guys go. I'm with you. If Jesus shows up again, I'm going to be there for it. And Jesus does reappear, much in the same way he had the week before, only this time he singles out Thomas. And he invites him, perhaps playfully, to touch his hands and stick his hand in his side where the soldiers pierced it with a spear. And there's no indication in the story that Thomas actually did reach out and touch Jesus, but the offer was there. It seems that Jesus makes this appearance for the sole purpose of graciously providing Thomas the proof he needed to believe. True to his word, as soon as Thomas sees the risen Jesus, he is instantly transformed from a skeptical doubter into a true believer. He immediately makes the most explicit confession about Jesus, not just in the Gospel of John, but in all the Gospels. My Lord and my God. This is the crescendo of the Gospel of John. This is it, the moment. After all that Jesus has said and done, after all the people who have misunderstood and rejected him, after his betrayal and arrest and trial and crucifixion, and now after his resurrection, it is Thomas who finally declares what John told us he was going to show us in the prologue way back in chapter 1, that Jesus really is God in the flesh. It's Thomas who says it, but he had to see it to believe it. Which then leads Jesus to pronounce a blessing on those who believe in him, in his resurrection, without seeing. It's a blessing on the first generation of Christians who heard and believed the testimony of the original disciples. It's also a blessing on subsequent generations who continue to believe without seeing, all the way down to you and me. Jesus' blessing is for us. I love the old story about a little boy whose dad was a preacher. And every day the boy would come in from outside, playing outside, and his mother would say, "You need to go wash your hands because there's germs in that dirt." And one day the little boy protested on his way to the bathroom and he said, "Germs and Jesus, Jesus and germs, that's all I ever hear about in this house, and I ain't never seen either one of them." And while many of us may identify with Thomas and his need for proof, Jesus is very quick to point out that he will not be making an appearance to every skeptic who refuses to believe without seeing. Thomas is the exception, because Jesus has a special mission for Thomas along with the other disciples. He's going to send them out into the world as his witnesses, his eyewitnesses to his life, death, and resurrection. And they will tell the world what they saw with their own eyes, what they heard with their own ears, what they touched with their own hands. And Jesus wants those of us to know, those of us who hear their testimony, who read their testimony, who believe it, who confess Jesus is Lord and God, he wants us to know, even though we've never seen the risen Lord with our eyes, we are just as blessed, just as included in the family of God as the original disciples who saw it all. And John immediately moves then from this blessing from Jesus into his purpose for writing his gospel. He says in chapter 20, verse 30 and 31, he said, "Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book." He could have told a much longer story. There was so much more he could say, but he said, "I didn't put it all in here. But the ones I did put in here, these are written that you may believe or continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name." John says, here's why I wrote this gospel. Here's why I wrote all of these things down, because I want my readers to believe and have life. The verb John uses in the original language for believe can be translated two different ways. One is as believe for the first time, coming to belief. In an evangelistic sense, John says, "I wrote these things so that you could believe. You didn't believe, but now you believe in Jesus and have life." But it can also be translated as continue to believe, as in don't stop believing. And while the Gospel of John has been proven through history to be a powerful evangelistic document, leading many, I'm sure some of you, to faith, it's more likely that John's original purpose in writing his gospel was to address beleaguered Christians whose faith in an unseen Jesus was waning. They were beginning to doubt, beginning to wonder if it's really true, not sure they can hang on much longer. And so John writes this story. He writes down what he saw and what he heard from Jesus to encourage them to keep on believing in the face of mounting opposition and ostracism and other kinds of difficulties. The Gospel of John exists. It was written down because faith without sight is not self-sustaining. Faith without sight is not self-sustaining. It has to be fed. It has to be reinforced. It has to revisit the events that gave birth to faith in the first place. Unfed, unreinforced, unrevisited faith easily slides into doubt and can easily fall into unbelief. And so John's solution to this is, let me as an eyewitness, he describes himself as an eyewitness several times in the gospel, let me as an eyewitness tell you what I saw and what I heard so that you can continue to believe, so that you don't give up your faith, so that you don't stop believing. He writes his gospel to help struggling Christians overcome their doubts. And there are many different kinds of doubt, many different forms of doubt. Doubt can take hold and grow in your mind and your heart for a number of different reasons. Doubt can be an intellectual or an emotional obstacle to faith. I myself am a chronic doubter. The last thing I ever want to do is belittle anyone who doubts or diminish anyone's doubts as if they are unimportant. One of the reasons I like Thomas so much is he's so open and honest about his doubts or his conditions for belief. I also love how the disciples, you notice, continued to make room for him in their circle, even though he doubted their testimony. Come on, Thomas, I thought we were buddies. We've been together for 3 years. How can you not believe what we're telling you? I just don't believe it until I see it. Okay, well, come on. Stay with us. Don't stop believing. Come on. As a chronic doubter, I know how doubt works. And I know what works to help keep doubt at bay. And I have learned from hard-earned experience that focusing on the presence of evil, the prevalence of evil in the world, does not reduce doubt or enhance faith. Neither does focusing on the seemingly meaningless innocent suffering or the suffering of the innocent. Nor does focusing on the foibles of the church and the hypocrisy of Christians. If you are looking for reasons to doubt, you can always find some close by. They're everywhere. But what I've learned in my own journey with doubt is one of the best ways to combat doubt that's teetering on the brink of unbelief is to keep returning to and focusing on Jesus, which is what John wants us to do in the gospel. Keep returning to and focusing on Jesus, who responded to the presence of evil in the world, who identified with the innocent who suffer, who forgave the hypocrisy of the religious leaders who conspired to kill him with a special kind of self-giving, sacrificial, cross-shaped love that is so powerful, so divine, that not even death could keep Jesus in the grave. That's what I focus on when I doubt. One of the reasons I preach, and this is true for several of my preaching buddies, although I'm not confessing for them, this is my own confession. One of the reasons I preach is not because I have so much faith. It's because I have so much doubt. And preaching tethers me to the stories of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection that are found in the Gospels. They hold my faith together. So if for whatever reason you find your faith in the risen but unseen Lord diminishing or even failing, I cannot emphasize enough how important it is to keep feeding your faith with the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection that we find in the Gospels. In other words, the more you doubt, the more you need to read the Gospels. And the more you need to stay connected to a church with other believers who are reading the Gospels with you, either online or in person. Trying to overcome your doubts, trying to work through your doubts as a free-ranged Christian, a free-range Christian, all by yourself, on your own, is a recipe for disaster. The more you doubt, the more you need to keep showing up in the places where Jesus keeps repeatedly showing up. And while we do not expect that he will show up in person to squash our faith like he did for Thomas, Jesus can and still does make his presence known among his people. When believers gather around the table, or gather to pray together, or gather to sing, or gather to serve one another, or gather to serve the community, Jesus is there. Jesus also keeps showing up faithfully and graciously when we read and hear and study and sit with and ponder and pray over the stories about him we find in the Gospels. The Spirit stirs among us, and the Jesus we read about on the page comes to life in our hearts and minds and in our church. May the gospel, the true story of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, continue to feed our faith in times of doubt, so that we can experience and enjoy the blessing Jesus calls forth for those who believe without seeing. Let's close by reading a final word, not from John, but from Peter. This is from 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. And let's all stand and read this together. Let's read it out loud together as a word of encouragement to one another. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Read with me, please. Though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy, for you are receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls.